In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And thank you for joining today here on the iSpy Radio Show. Today's show is one that we had planned before my wife's recent health troubles. And, you know, we just don't like to schedule guests and then not have them on, so we rescheduled them for this week. Today's show is about some rather important policy issues. And now, you might be thinking, ugh, why aren't you talking more about the election? Well, actually, we are. Although this is not about the candidates, it's about what's at stake in this election. More government control or more freedom from government? Less powerful agencies or larger, more intrusive ones? Let me give you an example. SpaceX versus Boeing. Back in 2014, the two companies were competing for contracts to ferry crews to and from the International Space Station. Both companies received contracts. SpaceX got about $2.6 billion. Meanwhile, Boeing got $4.2 billion. Not quite twice as much, but pretty close. Why did they get twice as much? Well, maybe they've got better lobbyists. Beginning in 2020, SpaceX managed to send at least 12 missions to the space station. Meanwhile, Boeing's Starliner took 4 extra years to finally get some crew to the space station. So, Boeing got paid more for the same job, they were slower, and the one they did get there was a disaster because they've stranded 2 astronauts while their unsafe capsule was sent back to Earth, empty. And now, most recently, SpaceX is facing all kinds of harassment from the government. Why? Well, most likely because the agency, directed by Biden and Kamala, doesn't especially like the owner, Elon Musk, who also owns Twitter, well, X, and is a staunch defender of free speech and refuses to knuckle under their pressure. So now, they're harassing SpaceX. You know, agencies are supposed to ensure good, fair, honest competition. But corrupt agencies can and will and do and have crippled good, successful companies. That's the nature of run-amok agencies. Instead of letting competition run its course, where in a normal world, Boeing would be forced to do better if it wants to succeed. Instead, the agency is attempting to bring SpaceX down to Boeing's level of incompetence and inferiority. How does that help anyone? Least of all Boeing. So we'll talk about that and more on today's show, just some of what is at stake in this election. I'd like to welcome back Kimberly Herman. She is the Executive Director for Southeastern Legal Foundation, an organization out there on the front lines fighting to defend your freedoms whenever the government strays and forgets they are supposed to be defending your rights and freedoms. Kim, it's great to talk to you again.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, so to orient our discussion, or for those who need a refresher or who just don't know about the Chevron deference or Chevron doctrine, as it's sometimes called, talk to us a bit about this SCOTUS ruling and how it impacted federal agencies and the rulemaking process.
Yeah, so back in the 1980s, it was around 1984, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion called Chevron. And basically what they were doing in this opinion is they were saying, we have various branches of government, right? We have our executive branch, which is our president, and our federal agencies. And then we have our legislative branch, which is Congress. We all know that Congress is our entity that our branch of government that actually passes and makes the laws. But sometimes they leave gaps in those laws. Maybe something doesn't get defined. Maybe technology changes, right? There's some sort of gap that might exist in that law. And so the agencies will then come in and fill that gap, right? Whether it's how something is going to be implemented, how the law is going to be implemented, how the law is going to be enforced. In 1984, with the Chevron case, the Supreme Court basically said that if something in that law is ambiguous, right? So maybe it was just so uncertain that the agency had to step in and give that additional guidance and fill that gap, that courts were going to defer to the agency's interpretation, right? So, for example, something that we're dealing with right now is Title IX. And in Title IX, Congress prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex, but they didn't define sex, Well, everyone knows in 1972, they meant biological sex, a man or a woman. Now we have the Department of Education coming in and redefining sex. They claim that they have the ability to do that and the courts should defer to them. We claim they don't. And so that's really what it was. It was giving the agencies a blank check to do whatever they want through these interpretations.
Well, we have talked with Craig Rucker from CFACT about this several times. Originally, when this ruling came down, as he said, it was a good thing because it was getting around these left-leaning judges who were kind of inserting themselves in the rulemaking process. And SCOTUS thinking at that time was these agencies have the experience, let them do their job. But as government often does, the intent got perverted and suddenly the agency seized power. And you saw things like agencies under Clinton doing things like crippling and shutting down the timber industry to save the spotted owl. The problem, it seems to me, is that Congress, when which is supposed to be setting the rules, didn't want to do that because it's hard work, and it's hard work to do hard work when cocktail parties are calling your name. So the issue is, in light of this ruling, will Congress get its act together and act like Congress was supposed to?
Oh, now where we are today?
Yeah.
And so I think, I mean, just to talk about what ruling we're talking about is that back in the 80s, we got Chevron deference, and for decades. Right. This doctrine got completely eroded. And I would debate whether or not it was good to begin with or whether we needed it or not. I think our structural limitations in our Constitution actually demand that our courts are the ones who are interpreting the law and filling the gaps. They're not writing the law. They're interpreting the law. Right. As Congress wrote it. But regardless, for decades, this doctrine expanded and expanded and expanded to the point where courts were not doing their job. And what the Supreme Court did this past June in cases called Loper, Bright, and Relentless is they came in and said, no, our Administrative Procedure Act, our statutes that govern what federal agencies can do, say that we should not be deferring blindly to these bureaucrats, because that's what these agencies are.
Right.
We have to remember, they are simply just bureaucrats that were put into office because the executive branch, whoever is the president, wanted them, or they were going to do whatever the president wanted them to do.
Right. Well, to me, this is really one of the biggest Supreme Court rulings in terms of untangling the deep state, you know, the administrative state. Is that how you see this ruling?
Yes. I mean, the importance of these rulings that came out in June cannot be understated. Our friends at New Civil Liberties Alliance handled these cases, and they just did an amazing job litigating these. You know, the major impact of these rulings is that now judges will be the ones to decide what a law means. That is their job. They are supposed to be interpreting laws through independent judgment. And it takes it out of the hands of bureaucrats, as I mentioned. And it's not just the interpretation. These agencies also have the ability to adjudicate enforcement actions. Right. Mm-hmm. And so they are imposing fines. Sometimes they are imposing criminal sanctions on people for violating rules. That now will return to the hands of the judges, which is where it should have been from the very beginning.
Right. OK, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we'll talk about the impacts of this moving forward. We're doing that with Kimberly Herman. She is the executive director of Southeastern Legal Foundation. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Kimberly Herman. She is the executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty, and will sue the government for its overreaches when it violates your constitutional rights. Their website is slfliberty.org. That's slfliberty.org. And you have a real-life example of this playing out right now, don't you?
We do, as a matter of fact. So we had filed a lawsuit this summer down here in federal court in Georgia, representing farmers, right? So representing these are the people who put the food on your table. And they were challenging a rule that came out from the Department of Labor where the federal agency unilaterally gave H-2A visa workers. So these are our foreign agricultural workers who come here for seasonal purposes, who we like and we need in this country, right, to be doing this work. But anyway, they come here for seasonal work. And the Department of Labor was giving them the right to unionize. Now, whether you like unions or not is beside the point. Congress specifically has said for 90 years that agricultural workers are exempted and excluded from the NLRA, which is our law that gives unionization rights. So American farmers do not have the right to unionize, farm workers, but now foreign farm workers have the right to unionize. And so we filed a lawsuit because Congress has not authorized the Department of Labor to do this. And the judge in that case leaned heavily on the fact that Chevron is gone, right? She explained that we as the judiciary don't have to defer blindly to the Department of Labor, and that these are powers that Congress has, and that the agencies cannot come in and just take them for themselves anymore. So the impact of Relentless and Loper Bright getting rid of Chevron is already having a huge effect in our courts and holding our agencies accountable.
Well, I absolutely love that. Assuming Congress doesn't pass some law that says that Congress is illegal, or otherwise screw things up and find some way to give away even more power to the agencies when it has been just been stripped from them, what's the impact of the Loper Bright decision? And again, that's the one that overturned the Chevron deference on future agencies and rulemaking. I mean, what would you expect or hope to see?
What I would hope to see is the agencies kind of get back in their lane, right? And that we have, Congress who actually does the legislating. And at the end of the day, you know, what we saw when President Trump took office in 2016, where he kind of had that rule of for every new regulation we need to get rid of too, that's what we need to see again.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, our federal agencies have become the fourth branch of government. And the problem is that they have taken for themselves the power of the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary all in one. And they've just taken that power. And so what happens in November is going to have a massive impact on the size of the bureaucracy, the size of the swamp, and what type of powers, constitutional or unconstitutional, our federal agencies then grab for themselves. I mean, this election is so important for so many reasons, and this is a major, major reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to talk to you about the ramifications of this on the election and what's at stake here in the next segment. But for now, up until now, regulatory agencies use their own experts to develop the rules and to apply the laws, which is why when it came to things like climate change, only global warming true believers were allowed as the experts, leaving the actual scientists who aren't making any money from global warming out in the cold. So does Loper Bright mean that when in the future, when they're attempting to figure out rules and regulations, that opposing views must be given a little more consideration than they have in the past? Or will this do nothing to get the politics out of policy? And we're always stuck with that.
I mean, I think the politics will always be in policy because those who want it to be there are going to insert it. But this at least helps when the lawsuits are brought, right? And so Chevron didn't actually have any real day-to-day impact or allowance on what these federal agencies can do, right? They're going to try to take as much power as they possibly can. It's when groups like ours with amazing clients actually challenge these rules in court, and we go to the court and we say, hey, the Department of Labor, hey, the EPA, hey, the Department of Education, they don't actually have the power to make these rules, right? That power sits with Congress. Then the courts will now have the chance to actually say, you know what, you're right. We are here to interpret it, right? And so they will do their job under that. But I mean, when you look at these agencies and you look at the experts like you talked about, the federal government gives grants to experts in the industry who then come in and then advise with the federal money that they were given exactly what the executive branch wants.
Right.
And so it's just a big circle.
Well, just on that point, why are those experts allowed to testify if they're getting money from those agencies? Isn't that a massive conflict of interest?
One would think so, right? But they work for NGOs, they work for universities, right? I mean, these are the problems that run really, really deep. So, you know, it's, hey, John Smith, I'm going to give you the money to go run a research project, and then John Smith, you're going to come with that research project, or, you know, Jane Smith is going to come in and grab that research project and come testify looking to it. And so, you know, I wish I didn't sound as cynical as the words that are coming out of my mouth. but, you know, that's what this administrative state is,
sure.
Whether or not it's what it was created for, that's what it's become. And that's why it's a huge problem in this country.
Well, we had asked Craig Rucker about whether this ruling could impact state laws and state agencies. And as a self-confessed non-attorney, He wasn't entirely sure whether it would or not. You being an actual attorney who fights agencies and rulemaking all the time, let's ask you this. Could this have a trickle-down effect on state agencies that they can't be out there just making up their own laws and rules without legislative oversight?
Yeah, so this is where state constitutional law comes into play. And many states have similar doctrines to Chevron. Some of them are actually codified, and some of them are just judicially created. And so where they're judicially created, the hope would be that those judges look at these opinions from the Supreme Court and say, you know what, we got it wrong too, right? We don't always get it completely right. We got it wrong when we gave away our judicial, duty to interpret these laws. And so we're going to take that back. And so I would hope that we start to see that. We don't really litigate in state courts a whole lot, but we have lots of friends that do. And I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more of those cases brought over the next year or two.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I'd like to ask you about a specific example here in Oregon that maybe this will come into play. Everyone stay with us. We'll take that up with Kim Herman after this. Southeastern Legal Foundation fights to defend your constitutional rights when government decides to run right over them. Their website is slfliberty.org. And we're talking with Kimberly Herman, their executive director. And so, Kim, I mentioned going on to that segment there that I'd like to bring up a real-world example of something that we're working on right now here in Oregon. And the current governor of Oregon is trying to force into place what she calls a climate protection plan. It is a carbon cap and trade scheme, better described as a sales tax on energy. And there was this ballot initiative some years ago to do something like this. It got rejected by the voters. There was an attempt to get a bill through the legislature to do this, but the legislature refused to pass it. The former governor, Kate Brown, did it by executive order, ordering her Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, to create a plan. But that plan was thrown out by Oregon's Supreme Court, which said that not only did they fail to meet public meeting laws, from their perspective, the DEQ didn't even appear to have tried to meet public meeting laws. So it's been rejected by the people, by the legislature, and now by the courts, but they're trying to do it again anyway. And so now the current governor, Tina Kotek, she is once again ordering her DEQ to put this plan together and trying to push it in through executive fiat. So in this situation, would the overturn of Chevron come into play on some level if the judge is hearing it? They know that the Supreme Court is already how they view these kinds of things, and that the legislature is superior to these agencies. So how would that play out, you think?
I mean, so if we actually, let's say that this comes down and then a lawsuit is filed, it would probably be filed in state court. And so Chevron is not going to be directly implicated, but it sets a general tone, right? And so whether or not it's a state agency or a state executive branch or a federal executive branch, when you see from the Supreme Court that, an opinion that basically says we have three branches of government, right? And this was specific in a lot of the concurrences that we saw in the Supreme Court opinions that we've been talking about. They really stressed we have three branches of government. That is both at a federal level and a state level. And so it sets a tone for our entire country that everyone really needs to stay in their lane, right? Let our legislatures, state or federal, do the legislating. Let them be the one that has the law and stop trying to ram different interpretations or executive orders down everyone's throat. The people don't want them, right? And so if they wanted them, then they would be passed through our legislatures.
Right. So in the time that we have left, I'd like to talk to you about what's really at stake in this election, because I think that's what the Loper-Bright decision and before it, the Chevron deference, where it really expanded the administrative state. I think that's back on the ballot this year. Do we want to go back to more agency control or less agency control? So let's start with Kamala. If she got herself elected, what would you expect her to do to try to re-empower the federal agencies and bureaucracies?
Oh, my goodness. I think that on day one, we're going to see a number of executive orders that give them marching orders to implement things like more equity, right? Which we all know is just a word to pit racial groups against each other.
Exactly.
We're going to see more executive orders basically telling them to go make new rules and regulations, right? Our Federal Register is going to greatly increase in size. I think that they're going to feel like they have a blank check to do whatever they want. And of course, that doesn't mean that lawsuits won't be filed to stop these rules and regulations, but that's exactly what we're going to see. The other thing that we're going to see is this, is we're going to see a lot of executive branch work being done through memos to the file, dear colleague letters, Q&A documents. And so I don't actually think that the agencies are going to use the APA process, which is required. So if you want to pass a rule, make a new rule, the agencies have to put out a proposed rule. They have to give the American public time to comment on them. And then they have to consider all of those comments. I think we're going to be back to the Obama days where they don't actually issue proposed rules. They don't pass these as actual regulations. Instead, they just issue memos to the file saying we're going to do whatever we want. And then they move forward with that. Those are a lot harder to challenge in court. And they know that.
To a large extent, the Biden administration, have they also done that, where they just do these memos rather than issuing proposed rules and look for comment?
They have done that, but I'll be honest, not to the exact same degree that we've seen with major things as we saw during the Obama administration. Now, granted, they're in a first term, and we also have a president who doesn't know whether he's in Washington, D.C. or New York. And so, you know, we're kind of in a very different situation than we were under Obama. The other thing is that when I say they're harder to challenge because they're harder to find. When you actually can find these dear colleague letters, they're not so hard to challenge in court because they haven't gone through the proper process. So a lot of times you can defeat them on procedural grounds. What we saw during this, during, you know, the first Biden-Harris term, if you will, is that they were actually doing this through rulemaking process because they wanted to try to make their changes permanent so they couldn't be rid of on a procedural issue. But we've had great success in challenging these in court.
So with this Loper-Bright ruling that throughout the Chevron ruling, would this keep her reined in some ways, or are there going to be just ways around this? You know, like you mentioned, they're just not even bothered to issue the proposed rules.
It will definitely rein them in to a degree that they're actually going to follow it, right? But unfortunately, what I expect to see from a potential Harris administration, God help us all, is that these agencies are going to still do what they want to do, right? So they're going to still be filling the gaps where they shouldn't be filling the gaps. They're still going to be trying to act like our federal judiciary through enforcement actions and such. It's just going to mean that we have to file more and more lawsuits than we ever have in the past, because we are going to have to stop them by going to the court over and over and the court saying, you don't have the authority to do that. We don't have to defer to your interpretation.
So on the other side, if Trump gets elected, how do you see him perhaps using this rule to further detangle and defang the deep state?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to see exactly what we saw during the first term with immediate orders to reduce regulation, right, and to cut any regulation that doesn't have to actually have to exist. I also think that we're going to see federal agencies not trying to interpret the law. So in other words, if there is an opening, if there is a gap, if there is something that they're unsure of, they are not going to be trying to rewrite the laws. You know, whether or not you agree with his policies, at the end of the day, when you look at 2016 to 2020, the reduction in our federal register, which is where all of these rules and regulations from the administrative state live, was the most significant reduction we have ever seen. Administrations don't reduce regulations. They only increase them normally. And so I think that we're going to see that to a huge degree.
Well, I would certainly hope so. I would love to see this government shrunk even further and get it out of our lives that much more. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Kimberly Herman, she is the executive director of Southeastern Legal Foundation. Their website, one more time, is slfliberty.org. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Today's show is about what's at stake in this election, and that means we're looking past the candidates to the administrations that they would form if elected. We just wrapped up with Kimberly Herman of the Southeastern Legal Foundation discussing a major aspect of any administration, the agencies, and how they would empower them or seek to rein them in, add regulation or cut regulations. But there's another aspect of federal government, the management or mismanagement of government land. Back in the Obama years, who was constantly, it seemed, working to lock up federal lands and make them even less accessible to the American people,
who are the true owners of that land. We talked a lot with the American Lands Council, which has been fighting for better access, health, and productivity on public lands and to see that they are lawfully managed. But it's been a while since we've talked with anyone from the American Lands Council, so I'm happy to welcome Myron Ebel back to the show, who is their chairman. Myron, it is great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, the last time we talked, you were with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, serving as the longtime director of CEI's Center for Energy and Environment. In fact, many people may not realize this, but we were talking to a genuine hero of the global warming skeptic community, and I just have to read some of these headlines because I just got such a kick out of them. Your bio on the totally fair and unbiased Wikipedia calls you an American climate change denier. EE News, or maybe it's pronounced EE News, a political subsidiary committed to providing nonpartisan reports on energy and the environment. And you can tell they are totally nonpartisan because their article about your retirement from CEI is titled "Loud and Proud Climate Change Denier Hangs It Up." And they go on to say, from helping to block cap and trade to scuttling the Paris Agreement, Myron Ebel has played a starring role in climate politics. Eric Pooley, in his 2010 book, The Climate War, described you as a superstar of the denialosphere. I just love that one. Business Insider wrote in 2009 that you might be enemy number one to the climate change community. Rolling Stone put you in the list of top six misleaders. And then finally, the Sierra Club said you are one of the single greatest threats our planet has ever faced. I mean, good Lord, when your enemies hate you that much, you just have to laugh. But you are also clearly doing something right. If you had to hazard a guess as to why, what did you do that to be hated that much and right at the top of their hate list?
First of all, I think obviously these are at least slight exaggerations. second, the left works by demonizing their enemies. So I became a prominent target even going back to the 90s when I was working on property rights issues and federal lands issues, because they discovered that I was one of a small group of people that had figured out how to block enactment of new wilderness areas and new wild and scenic river bills and that kind of thing. And so when I took up global warming and energy 25 years ago, I was already a target, and so it was easy to just pick up where they left off after I started. I was one of the organizers of the what we might call the climate realist community in D.C., mm-hmm. and so I was more prominent than a lot of people who actually did more work and were more effective, because I was kind of at the center of the organizational chart. And so, so I was just one of several people that they've targeted over the years as being an enemy of planet Earth and humanity.
Well, clearly you had some pretty good arguments that they just had a hard time trying to dispel. And of course, when it comes to global warming and climate change skepticism, of course people should be skeptical. I mean, that's the business of science, is to be skeptical of science. And it's unfortunate they just seem to think that you can only have one opinion when it comes to science. You are a native Oregonian, born and raised in Baker County, and so you know a lot about the mismanagement of federal lands because there's so much of it in Oregon. 53% of Oregon is owned by the federal agencies. But after retiring from CEI, you then took on the chairmanship of the American Lands Council. That's not a whole lot of a retirement there, but remind our audience about the American Lands Council, what they do, and what do you do for them as chairman?
Yes, thank you. Well, in 2012, the state of the Utah legislature passed a bill, enacted a bill sponsored by freshman legislator Ken Ivory, called the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act. And that bill was based on a huge amount of historical and legal research by two county commissioners in southern Utah, southwestern Utah, I think. Bill Howell and Bill Redd. And what they discovered was that the federal government is under a constitutional obligation to dispose of federal mm-hmm. land once a territory becomes a state.
Right.
And that this goes way back to the Louisiana Purchase when Thomas Jefferson was president in the early 19th century. And there were fights over the years between between various states that were entered into, that became states by congressional enactment, like Ohio and Alabama and so on, to get the Congress to transfer the land, to dispose of it, as the Constitution says that the federal government must do when a state becomes a state. But for some reason, that petered out once you got past to the Rockies and further west. And partly it's because the federal government had changed the route by which they were disposing of the land. They were, instead of giving it to the state, they were letting people homestead it, so private citizens could take up a claim and have a homestead. Well, when you get to the semi-arid and arid west, 320 acres or 640, one square mile for a couple, you're not going to be able to survive in most of the mountainous west on 640 acres. You might need 6,400 acres, or in Nevada, maybe 64,000 acres. And so there were other reasons, but basically the federal government stopped disposing of the land. Mm. So the American Lands Council was started, and it was started by Ken Ivory, who was the first CEO of it, after the 2012 bill to promote and support the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act, both in Utah and in other western states. In other words, to build public understanding and support for why we need to transfer the lands to the state.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you, their assessments. We talked with Ken Ivory quite a bit, and I agree that I don't think constitutionally the federal government can hang on to those. I'd like to see them point to where in the Constitution it says they could. Okay, it is time for break. So what if the government holds on to all those federal lands? Why does it matter, and what could possibly go wrong? Well, we'll talk about that next with Myron Ebel, chairman of the American Lands Council. Check out their website at AmericanLandsCouncil.org.
And now, some insights from the most powerful DEI hire in the land.
You know, home ownership for too many people in our country now is elusive. You know, gone is the day of everyone thinking they could actually live the American dream. And looking holistically at the connection between that and housing, and looking holistically at the incentives we in the federal government can create to actually engage in planning in a holistic manner that includes prioritizing affordable housing.
We just need to move past the failed policies that we have proven don't work. We need to guard that spirit. We have to guard that spirit. Let it always inspire us. Let it always be the source of our optimism. And let that then inspire us by helping us to be inspired.
Wow. Who knew Joe was the smart one? We're talking about what's at stake in this election, and one of the many things at stake is our American lands, which are being held wrongly, in my opinion, by the federal government. We're talking about that with Myron Ebel, the chairman of American Lands Council, an organization that supports legal action and legislative steps by states to gradually take possession of the federally controlled lands within their own borders and to manage them responsibly, which is something the federal government is not doing. You can visit AmericanLandsCouncil.org for more information. And just to go back into that last segment there about the constitutionality of it, for the people that defend the federal government hanging onto these lands, where exactly in the Constitution do they point to defend the federal government hanging onto all of these? Because as I recall, they're only allowed to hang onto federal lands for roads, military bases, and for post offices. So why are they hanging onto tens, literally hundreds of, I think, 640 million acres? Yeah.
Right. Well, the property clause, which is Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, Clause 3, says that the federal lands are held, the lands are held by the federal government for disposal when the territories become states. But it also says, and I should be able to quote this exactly, but it also says, and to make such necessary regulations for managing the land. It isn't clear enough that the regulations for managing the land are temporary. They're until such time as the land is disposed of. But that was always the understanding. So, and it was the understanding when the Constitution was drafted, and even going back to the Continental Congress, it was understood that if new states were created out of the territories of the out in the hinterland west of the 13 colonies, that those lands would the federal government would take control of the territory within it that say, you know, the state of Virginia at one point claimed a huge amount of, mm-hmm. of land west of what's now Virginia. And so it would take control and it would manage those lands and provide government until such time as it became a state, at which time those lands would be disposed of. So that's how they do it. They say, well, see, they don't have to dispose of it. They can dispose of it or they can manage it. And so that's kind of the trick that has been played. And there's been some bad court decisions going back quite a long ways. And some more recent ones. I think Kleppe is 1976. So it's a disputed area. I think most of the facts and the history is on the side that the land has to be disposed of. But there is an argument.
Yeah. Oh, I would agree. Because once you become a state, those lands ought to belong to the state then at that point. And as we know, there is a lot of mismanagement by these federal lands. For example, we tend to get some forest fires here in Oregon, and as it turns out, most of the largest out-of-control fires are on federal lands. Is that due to them being so remote that it's hard to get there before they spread, or is it simple mismanagement of those lands?
No, it's long-term mismanagement of our national forests and our Bureau of Land Management lands, and you could also say the same of some of the big national parks. You know, when I was growing up in Baker County, our ranch land, which adjoined BLM land and Forest Service land, some of it still does, you know, there wasn't a real threat from fires because we had very active management of the land mm-hmm. by the land agencies, and that included cutting trees. If you stop cutting trees, the alternative management is catastrophic forest fire. So you don't see catastrophic forest fires on private forests in the Northwest. You see it on national forests and BLM forests. Now, mm-hmm. of course, sometimes they spill over, but they become less catastrophic as they move into private forests. They don't burn the soil down to 3 or 4 or 5 inches because they're not as hot, because there isn't as much fuel buildup. So to just give you one statistic, I believe in 1990, the national forests were cutting 14 billion board feet of timber, and there was estimated growth of 17 billion board feet. So that was a pretty good balance, because some of that 17 billion dies as it gets older. So, but by 2000, they were down to 3 billion board feet. And later it got down to 2 billion board feet. So if you have that massive amount of fuel buildup, you're going to have catastrophic fires.
Absolutely.
The other, besides environmental mismanagement, the other side of the BLM and the Forest Service is economic mismanagement. As you said, closing things down and stopping human activities and human access, that's why so many of these rural communities are in such terrible shape economically, and they're you know mm-hmm. poor, and they're getting smaller, and they're dying because you get the cat more, you cut down more and more on the number of cattle that can be grazed. Well, that's not good for the rangeland, because the range, if it isn't grazed, will turn into brush, and then the cattleman whose number of livestock is cut down, he no longer has a viable operation, so he gives up. And so the economy of timber and grazing and mining, which is what the rural West depends on in most areas, those have just been progressively closed down. And you said 52 or 53% of Oregon is federally owned. Well, that's over 50% of the West and Alaska is federally owned. In Nevada, it's 87%. In Utah, it's close to 70%. In California, it's 46%. So there's just way too much federal land, and it's bad for the environment, and it's bad for the economy.
Absolutely, it is. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. What's at stake in this election? The future of federal lands. We'll talk about Trump versus Harris when it comes to federal lands next. And we're back in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show. We're wrapping things up with Myron Ebel. He's the chairman of American Lands Council, an organization dedicated to help states get their lands promised to them by the federal government when they were given statehood. The federal government currently holds over 640 million acres of land still. So I just want to touch on one thing real quick here. Utah has now finally filed a lawsuit with the Supreme Court. It was filed back on August 20th, 2024. And this is to challenge the constitutionality of the federal government's infinite retention of millions of acres within state borders. So just real quick, can you give us a nutshell description of what this is about and the status of this?
Yes, well, it goes back to the passage of the Transfer of Public Lands Act in 2012. And it's taken another 12 years for the state of Utah to get its act together and file suit at the Supreme Court. They did that, as you said, in August, and they first have to convince the Supreme Court to take the case.
Right.
And that requires four justices saying that they think it's something that the court ought to consider. And so, you know, there are three conservative justices, and then you can take your pick. The Utah will need to either get Chief Justice Roberts or Kavanaugh or Barrett to join the other three conservatives. And then I think the case has good prospects. I think it's been put together. I think it makes a strong constitutional case that the federal government has to start disposing of these federal lands. The case has some other oddities that may develop. I don't know what's going to happen if the Supreme Court takes the case, whether some other states will decide to intervene as well. On either side, I mean, the state of California or Oregon might decide, hey, we want to keep our federal lands just like they are and lock them up more and more forever. So we're going to oppose this and we're going to join the federal government side, which might, you know, keep the case going, because if President Trump is elected again, he may his Department of Justice and Interior Department and Forest Service may say, hey, well, you know, they got a case here. Let's do some settlement. So, but if California is an intervener or Oregon or some other state on the other side, they could say, hey, no, wait a minute. No, we want to make our arguments here. You can't settle this.
You know, I would say fine. Let Oregon, California, the feds keep their lands, but the states that want them back, I think they ought to be able to take those.
That's right.
Yeah. I hope that the court will take this on. I don't know how much any of those justices have any real experience with the vastness of the West and the lands and all of that. I sometimes get the sense that they don't really have a keen understanding of these lands and mm-hmm. what happens there. Yeah,
but wait a minute. Neil Gorsuch is from Colorado.
That's true. I forget about Neil.
He was practicing law in Colorado. He was a judge in Colorado. And his mother, who was a state senator, became Reagan's EPA administrator. So he knows a lot about the federal lands and also about the environmental problems.
Yeah.
So he can educate the others.
I hope so. And like you said, it only takes four out of nine. So it doesn't have to be majority. So four out of nine just to take up the case. So, getting into the two prospective candidates here and what their administrations might look like. Just the news reported on Wednesday that this year was the first time since 1958 that the federal government held no oil and gas lease sales, none for the whole year. And they would have had zero last year as well in 2023, but had to sell some because of a loophole in the Green New Deal bill. I think zero oil and gas leases on federal lands in 2024, an election year when people are going to be paying attention to these kinds of things, that's a pretty strong indicator of how a Kamala administration would have handled things, I would think.
Yes. The strategy of the preservation groups and the environmental groups going back to the 1960s, it's a very long-term strategy to lock up the federal lands from human access. And, you know, we first got the Wilderness Act in 1965, and we've had all kinds of bills since then. And starting with Obama, they they switched because it became much harder to pass these lockup bills in Congress. And so instead of passing new wilderness bills, they create wilderness study areas, which are de facto. They're managed as wilderness because they claim that, well, Congress may want to turn this into a wilderness area at some point. Or the BLM has areas of critical environmental concern, and then the president can turn federal lands into national monuments and then lock up whatever they want. So their strategy is to lock up the federal lands from human access, and that includes recreational access, particularly motorized. They close thousands and thousands of miles of roads every year throughout the West. And then from economic access, from resource access. So no oil and gas leasing, get the cattle off the land, stop forest timber production, and do everything you can to stop mineral exploration and mineral production, because the general mining law of the 1870s is still in effect. So they can't get around that entirely, but they're trying to.
Well, locking things up in a wilderness area, I think, could be better described as a kindling factory. But we'll leave that aside there for now. You know, I suspect Trump would be open to releasing large swaths of land. You've kind of already alluded to that. What's the process to do that? Can he do it alone as executive, or does it take an act of Congress to give to states what was already promised to the states at the time of statehood?
Well, yeah, I think this is very complicated, and I'm not a lawyer. I think that a Trump Department of Justice could actually settle the case favorably, but it would still be up to Congress to then start disposing of the lands. Hmm. And as you said, it would be up to the states to decide whether they wanted to accept some of the lands, all of the lands, or not at all. So if Utah said, we want all 37 million acres that's federal, maybe the Congress would do that. But if California said, well, we only want, 100 acres here because we want to, pay off Nancy Pelosi or something, they could do that. So, I don't, there's a lot I don't know about how this might go forward.
Well, we certainly hope things will go better under Trump, because we know they won't under Kamala, and that's kind of where we're at with this election. Myron Ebel, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun to talk to you.
That is all of our time for today. We certainly hope you're at least a little wiser for having been here. Today's show is 14-39. You can find that at iSpyRadio.com. And as every week, check the show notes section for links to our guest websites, further information, and a whole lot more. Better, more educated voters make better choices. And this year, choose wisely. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.